Many New Zealanders are fans of The Chase on TV, a traditional quiz show given major twists. And Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is similarly traditional once you subtract the razzmatazz, I suppose. The quizzes run by our major print media are well subscribed, and a sizable number of Kiwis go to school quizzes or pub quizzes where I suppose questions arise about whether teams should be allowed to buy answers, even if the extra money does go to good causes. But people have a lot of fun nights out. If you wish you were better at quizzes, our next guest says the answer lies less these days in memorising facts and curiosities and more in being able to use your brain to work answers out. Samant Subramanian is a writer and journalist based in India. Right now, he's the Leon Levy Biography Fellow at the City University of New York. His second book, This Divided Island, Stories from the Sri Lankan Civil War, was nominated for the Samuel Johnson Prize and the Royal Society of Literature's Ondaatje Prize. Samant is also a quiz nut. Hello, Samant.
Hi, how are you?
You're a big-time quiz contestant. And you have been to Vegas, actually. I don't know if it's the mecca of quizzing, but you've been to Vegas to be in quizzes.
Yeah, in fact, the only time I've ever been to Vegas is to take part in a quiz. This was last year, around this time last year, when there was a company called Geeks Who Drink that set up this evening-long quiz. And so six of us went to Vegas from different parts of the U.S. to take part in this quiz.
Geeks Who Drink.
Geeks Who Drink. They do pub quizzes across the US, and they did this once a year blowout, and it happened to be in Vegas last year.
Many of us are used to kind of the entertainment factor being ramped up and just the little local quizzes we do, but you had Vegas performers appearing live as part of the quiz.
You know, there was one round where they got Vegas street performers to come in and sort of mime or act out scenes from famous movies, and then we had to guess the movies. That was a 10-question round. It was enormously entertaining. The only Elvis impersonator I saw during my weekend in Vegas was on that stage at the quiz.
And Las Vegas quiz nights have gimmicks galore. You had to match snacks with celebrities.
You had to match a snack with a celebrity to come up with sort of an easy portmanteau. So the one I remember right now is Ovaltine and Tina Turner. So you'd come up with Ovaltina Turner.
Gotcha.
That was one of the examples that was given. And so you had 10 questions where you had to recognize these snacks and these celebrities and put them together.
You've taken part also. You've taken part in the World Quizzing Championship. And is that by referral only? That's quite select.
No, anybody can write it, actually. The World Quizzing Championship happens, as the name suggests, all over the world. It's a written quiz. It's 8 rounds of, I think, 240 questions totally. And you just, you know, on a particular day, whenever your country or your city decides to host it, you sit down and write it. It's sort of like an exam. It's sort of really hardcore quizzing.
Quizzes have got more show busy. They're not what they used to be. And you think that's all right, don't you? I mean, formerly, they would favour those of us with good memories, you know, in inverted commas, and now they don't. They've changed. Do you quite like the change?
I do. I mean, I wouldn't say they've gotten show busy, although there is, of course, sort of a breadth of subject matter that includes movies and cinema and so on that is quite interesting and exciting to work on. But I think more than anything else, the nature of the quiz question itself has changed, and I think there's a lot more emphasis being put on quizzes these days, where the questions are things that you can work out. There's sort of little clues scattered in the question, and then you put them together maybe over the team, and so one person knows one part of it and somebody else knows the other part, and you come up with an answer. It's almost as if you're deducing it rather than just knowing it out, right out.
I suppose quizzes always respected lateral thinking, but you're saying not to the extent that they do now.
I think that's right. I think because there's such a breadth of subject matter these days, I mean, you know, that the only way to sort of have it be accessible to everyone is to make sure that even if you aren't sort of a film buff, you can still put something together and put an answer together in a film round and still be interested in the quiz.
How did you do in Vegas? How do you do generally in quizzes?
You know, it depends on the kind of quiz. I mean, you know, in Vegas, we were a team of 6 of us, and I think 5 of us were not Americans. So we didn't get a lot of the really niche American stuff. So I think we came 100th out of 200 odd teams, which was okay. I think I tend to do better in things like the World Quizzing Championship. I tend to do better in quizzes back home in India, where the questions are, you know, sort of obviously things that I might have grown up with or I'm more familiar with. So I tend to do okay by and large, but I do tend to enjoy myself wherever I go.
I get the feeling you do. What are your strong? Yeah. What are your strengths? What are your strong points as a team member?
Art and literature, I guess. Maybe a little history. I don't do well on sport, film, quite often. These are sort of my big areas.
You see, it's an area that, or areas that fly underneath the radar. Has television, for example, neglected quizzes? Because a lot of them seem online or in obscure places.
Well, I think British television in particular has sort of an interesting range of television shows that are devoted to quizzing. Things like Only Connect, which is a quiz show that is based entirely on lateral thinking, and there's episodes of that available on YouTube in case anybody wants to have a look. So there is, I think there's, and of course you have these big, glitzy, glamorous Who Wants to Be a Millionaire kind of shows where the questions perhaps are not that challenging, but, you know, there's a sense of a huge reward at the end of the quiz. So there's quite a wide spectrum. And I think that renaissance in TV quizzing has only happened over the last 15 years or so.
Yeah, you've got to add the artifice now, though. I suppose that was always true. You tried to add whatever artifice you could rustle up to brighten the look of the quiz. But you think quizzes are alive and well?
I think so. And I think offline quizzing, I mean, quizzes that are happening away from the television sort of eye in universities or in little quiz clubs around the world, I think that is really particularly thriving, and I'm really happy for it.
You learn a lot from quizzes, and you learnt, well, I assume you didn't know it already, that the names of hydrogen and oxygen should be switched. And it's kind of something we never think about until someone points it out.
That's right. I mean, I think the best kind of quizzes or the best kind of quiz-worthy facts or the best questions are those that is right under your nose and nobody ever notices it. And so those are really the kind of things that I tend to remember the most fondly.
Greek for water former and acid former, hydrogen and oxygen, so they should actually be reversed.
That's absolutely right. And it wasn't something that struck me at all until I read it in an article a couple of weeks ago.
I know. It's a lovely little revelation when it's pointed out. Why do men dominate quizzes? And is that as true as it used to be?
I think it's maybe less true than it used to be, but it's still sort of largely true. And the funny thing is it's true all over the world, to the extent that you can't sort of ascribe it to a cultural quirk of one country or the other. And I think the only explanation I can come up with is that a lot of these domains of knowledge that were traditionally sort of academic were dominated by men well into the 20th century. So I think as a spillover effect of that, even as academia has sort of opened its doors to more and more women, as it rightly should, I think these kind of informal knowledge settings still have some way to go before they get the gender balance right.
We're talking with Samarth Subramanian about quizzing in the first instance. And it's a great feeling, isn't it? And you write about this, to know that although you can't compete with the know-everything nerds, you can still know something that no one else does. It happened to me once with considerable pride. But has it happened to you as well?
Sometimes not just you. You're not just the only person on your team who knows the answer. You're the only person in the room
yes.
who knows the answer.
Yes.
And I think that's, you know, it's sort of a special, it's a really special feeling because everybody's life is unique and everybody sort of comes to a quiz with all this knowledge they've sort of learned, but also just soaked up along the way. And you know, somebody said this to me a couple of days ago, which I thought was particularly nice, is that the sweetest answer that you get in a quiz is the answer that you have no right to know. It's not something that you work with day in and day out. It's not part of your day job. It's just something that you've picked up along the way and it's just sort of lodged itself into your brain. And you pull it out in the midst of a quiz and that's the most satisfying feeling.
Can you think of a time when you were the only person in the room who knew the answer?
There was a question that started off with the words President Chetty Jagan. And I buzzed in at that point, and I just, you know, I assumed that they were looking for the country that this guy was the president of, and I said Guyana, which turned out to be right. But I had never studied the history of Guyana. I knew nothing about the politics of it. I just remember that name from a very random UNESCO advertisement that played on TV during a cricket series years ago, during a West Indies series. And it just sort of lodged itself in my brain. And, you know, there was considerable consternation when I buzzed in and got it right.
Do you want to hear the one I remember most?
I really do.
Okay. Who was the first person ever to come up with, "Every day in every way, I'm getting better and better"?
Gosh, okay.
It's a good one,
isn't
it?
And what's the answer?
The answer is Émile Coué, who was, I think, a 19th century French chemist. And God knows God knows where I read it. And I've never seen it referred to much, but it came up that night in the quiz, and I couldn't believe it.
Just a reflection of what life is like. I mean, we move through life and we think we only learn stuff when we sit down and read it out of a book or kind of read it online and when we're actively learning. But it just shows that we passively learn all the time as well.
Are you quite generous-minded? I mean, is it irritating? Because this happens to a lot of New Zealanders. I don't mean the irritation, but they get into a team maybe for a good cause, you know, raising funds for the local sports team or the local school, so you don't grumble about what's in the quiz. But everything they ask is either sport or celebrity or maybe a series of obscure national flags. Do you know what I mean? Does it kind of annoy you that there isn't more scope in the kind of quizzes people do most?
It does sometimes. I mean, sometimes when I go to a pub quiz and sort of things are out of the tabloids or out of the, you know, the recent sports results and nothing else, I think that's a shame because I think there's a wasted opportunity there to just go much wider and still have the quiz be a lot of fun to a lot of different people. But there's a lot of pub quizzes that get it right, that do books rounds and history rounds and so on in the middle of their celebrity and pop culture rounds. And so it becomes fun for everyone.
Yeah, no, there are great ones as well. You're quite right. What do you mean when you say, with quizzing, the world comes slowly into focus question by question?
Well, I just mean that, you know, when you go to a quiz and you sort of sit down and there's a question that's presented to you, even if you don't know the answer right off the bat, with a really good question, there is still the possibility that you're working the question out with the clues that are provided with your team. And so it's almost, you know, the process of going from not knowing to knowing within the space of a single question is itself a process of discovery, and you're discovering something about the world and the way it works in the frame of that one question. And I think it's that process of discovery that's really the most fascinating thing about quizzing. And so you're learning how to learn, in a sense, or you're learning how to discover. And that sort of keeps that process alive for you, even as you sort of, when you leave the quiz and go out onto the world.
Yeah, no, nicely described. Can I run a couple or three questions by you, maybe just for a bit of fun?
Absolutely. Let's give it a go.
Which of Sri Lanka's official languages also has official status in Singapore and parts of India?
That would be Tamil.
That would be right. Thinking of sitcom addresses on TV, who lived in the very fancy address of 508 St. Cloud Road?
St. Cloud Road.
Ah, gotcha.
This is a good one.
Sitcom famous star.
Okay. I'm not sure. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Ooh, that's a good one.
It's a good one, and I wouldn't have known it because I see it on TV in the background, but I've never actually watched it.
Right.
Among land animals, what species has the largest eyes? There's a choice of three. Gibbon, owl.
Sure.
Gibbon, owl, ostrich.
Ostrich, maybe.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
The southernmost country in the European Union with no Mediterranean coastline. Southernmost one in the EU.
Southernmost one with no Mediterranean
no
coastline.
No Mediterranean coastline.
Would that be Croatia?
No, it would be Portugal.
Portugal. Ah, okay. I didn't know it doesn't touch the Mediterranean. That's interesting.
Yeah, exactly. But you don't always think of that.
Yeah.
I've got another geographical one. Only one U.S. state shares a border with only one other state. Which one? Short border, short answer. Which state shares a border with only one other state?
Would that be Maine?
Yes, you are correct, sir.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Which country which country has the longest coastline?
That would have to be the US.
You know, I would have thought Russia, but it's only fifth. And it's Canada, followed by...
Canada?
I know, followed by Norway. And I did a real double take with Norway, but there must be lots of indentations in the Norwegian coast.
That's right. It's those little sort of fractal-type coastlines that probably give it more length. How fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? What technology perfected in 1882 let New Zealand make maximum money from its farms? What technology? This is hard for you.
What technology for in New Zealand? Is it the seed drill?
Wasn't that Jethro Tull? I can't remember. shipping frozen meat, the ability to ship frozen meat to the UK.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
That was a hard one for you. And the kiwi, the kiwi fruit was called what originally?
I'm not sure.
Ah, stumped you. The Chinese gooseberry.
Yeah.
Chinese gooseberry.
Chinese gooseberry. Okay.
Well, at least it was in this neck of the woods. I hope one of those comes up for you one day in a quiz.
I hope so. I'm going to a tournament here in Cambridge on Saturday. It would be fantastic if one of these came too.
The wide-eyed ostrich.
The wide-eyed ostrich.
Can I get a bit more serious? This divided island, if we can move away from quizzes if you don't mind, because although it's been very entertaining to talk about them. This divided island stories from the Sri Lankan Civil War. You are a Tamil. In Sri Lanka, the Tamils did really well and were resented for doing well, it seems, by some of the Sinhalese. They benefited arguably from empire, from colonialism. What's your take on that?
Well, it was sort of an accident of history, really. I mean, Sri Lanka was ruled by three successive European imperial powers, but in the north and the east of the island, the schools that were set up were typically American missionary schools. And the Tamils who lived in the north and the east would go to these schools and they would sort of be taught in English, whereas in the rest of the island, the British would leave it to the Sinhalese to set up their own Sinhalese language schools. And so this knowledge of English over time gave the Tamils an advantage in terms of getting into university, getting into the government to get jobs and so on. And so when Sri Lanka became independent in the 1940s, the Tamils were disproportionately represented in universities and employment. And so that didn't go down well with the Sinhalese, who are the majority, after all, in the island. And so that's where the friction between these two communities began.
Sri Lanka's new president, or recent president, has appointed two of his brothers to top jobs. Mm-hmm. What does that presage for a harmonious future for the country? What do you think the state of ethnic relations or religious relations is there now?
Well, it's kind of fraught, I'd imagine, because the same three brothers or the same family used to rule Sri Lanka a little over 5 years ago. And they were the brothers who were in power when the war ended in 2009. The war ended quite brutally with thousands of Tamil civilians killed or disappeared. And so for these brothers to come back to power again with sort of a slight rearrangement of posts is worrying, because these are not known to be politicians who are overly friendly to the minorities like the Tamils. They are themselves, they stand accused of war crimes, and that has never been resolved. And so I think the next few years are going to be quite perilous for minorities in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, so much seems never to have been resolved. And yet the country has one of the fastest growing economies in the world, I was reading.
That's right. I mean, but growing from a smaller base, we have to we have to remember. And the fact that the war ended in 2009, just the cessation of the war alone meant that the economy sort of received a certain fillip in the post-war era.
Author and quizzer Samant Subramanian is with us. Your first book made your reputation, I think, to considerable extent. It was, you know, a much lighter and more idiosyncratic book, Following Fish, around the Indian coast. What gave you the idea for doing that?
Gosh, I can't take credit for it. I have to say that at some point I was talking to an editor at Penguin Books, and we came up with this idea together. It wasn't my idea, but the idea of a travel book that is thematically linked through these several essays, but within each essay is free to go off and explore some part of culture or society or history, that really did appeal to me. So the book itself is a set of 9 essays linked through this theme of fish. But of course, there's so many different ways to look at fish. I mean, you can talk about it as food or culture or history. The environmental aspect is particularly relevant these days. And so I enjoyed that process of sort of spinning off these ideas from a single theme.
Yeah, you could tell you enjoyed it. The question a lot of interviewers about that book always asked you, the Hyderabad family that has for generations offered a popular cure for asthma that involves swallowing a live murrel fish. Now, does that work?
Well, we don't know. I mean, I have asthma, and I did take the fish once. I did swallow the fish once, but you're supposed to do it 3 years in a row, I think, to be completely cured. And so I've never been able to confirm or deny. But I certainly met a number of people who were utterly convinced of the fact that this fish works, even though there's no scientific reason it should at all.
And the thing is, it's not claimed to work on the spot, is it? You need to go on a diet for 45 days as well as eating the fish, swallowing the
fish.
That's
right. And then you come back the next year and the year after, and then maybe after that you're cured, but who knows?
Okay. Well, I suppose after all that time, if you're still wheezing, the family members might be hard to contact.
No, they're there every year. I mean, you might sort of be able to go there and get your... The thing is that the treatment is free, so it's impossible to go there and demand your money back because you haven't paid anything in the first place.
What's it like swallowing a live murrel fish?
Oh, you know, it's gone before... It's a murrel fingerling, so it's tiny. It's about sort of the first two joints of your little finger. I mean, that's sort of how long it is, and it's down your throat before you can before you realize it. It goes by really fast.
Well, I won't ask you what the science is because you say there is none, but I will ask you what makes Mangalore fish curry seemingly the best on the planet.
Or the best I've eaten, at any rate. It's just the it's the smoothest, most balanced curry I've ever eaten. It's sort of this deep red gravy that isn't overly spicy, but is at the same time, it has these delicate notes of flavor to just complement the fish so well. And I'm getting really hungry as I'm talking about this. But I urge anyone listening to sort of seek it out when they can. It's fantastic. It's really the best fish curry I ate in India.
I wonder if you can Google the ingredient, or at least the putting together parts, the recipe online.
I'm sure it should be able to. Yeah, it should be possible to do that.
So, what's next on your agenda? You write books, you do quizzes. You're a man of many parts. What are your plans?
I have a new book out on the scientist and communist J.B.S. Haldane, who was a British geneticist in the first half of the 20th century, and whose life is, enormously exciting and rich and varied, but also has all these extremely relevant themes for us to consider about the marriage of science and politics and the ethics of genetics and genetic control. I think even more than when he was around, I think these questions are more relevant today. And so I wrote a biography of him that's out in the UK and the US this coming July.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. Yeah, those questions you refer to are kind of elbowing their way into conversation more and more, aren't they?
They really are. I mean, I think within 10 years' time, we would have sort of advanced so much in our grasp of genetic technology that the moral dimensions of this will have to be considered quite rapidly.
Yeah, no, it's a timely consideration for a book. Thank you very much for giving us your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It was so great to be on the show.
Samant Subramanian.